The people of Rome were shocked when they heard the news. Gregory was one of the wealthiest men in the city. His great-great-grandfather had been pope. His father was a wealthy noble with vast estates in Sicily. He was heir to all the family's possessions and had been named prefect of Rome while still a young man. He had everything to live for, so they thought. Yet here he was resigning his post, selling all he owned and giving it all away to the poor? History tells us nothing about what Gregory's father thought about this, but chances are that his mother's influence had something to do with it. We find her name in the Roman Martyrology as Saint Sylvia. The Roman Martyrology is the official list of saints honored in the Roman liturgy, so called because for the first few hundred years they were all martyrs. As for Gregory's papal ancestor Felix III, we do not know if his offspring were born before he became a cleric, as in the case of Augustine, or after. Married clergy, including bishops, were becoming increasingly rare in the West at this time. One thing that Gregory kept was his family villa in Rome, located near the Circus Maximus. This he turned into a monastery under the patronage of St. Andrew. Selecting an experienced monk as abbot, Gregory submitted himself completely to his spiritual direction and authority. The next several years of prayer and seclusion at this abbey were the happiest and most tranquil of Gregory's life. Unfortunately, this mayor-turned-monk was more zealous in fasting than his body could handle. For the rest of his life, he struggled with ill health. Gregory's serenity came to a screeching halt when the Pope became aware of his talents and named him, much to his horror, as one of the seven deacons of Rome. Fortunately, he could still live with his brothers in the monastery, but not for long. Shortly after his ordination, he received a very uncongenial assignment. The Pope needed an ambassador to the Emperor in Constantinople, and he thought the former prefect of Rome was the perfect man for the job. The last thing Gregory wanted was to leave the spiritual atmosphere of St. Andrew's Monastery to go to the worldliness of the imperial court. As a safeguard, he took a few of his monastic brothers with him. Somehow, despite the fact that he knew no Greek, he managed to hold his own. Nevertheless, he found shocking the corruption, intrigue, and vanity of the court. He saw clearly that the internal and external problems besetting the empire meant that Rome could not realistically expect much help from the emperor in defending itself from the barbarians. After 6 long years in Constantinople, Gregory was called back to Rome, where he became abbot of St. Andrew's Monastery and continued in the pope's service. A few years later, in AD 590, a destructive flooding of the Tiber led to a severe plague that claimed the life of the pope. Gregory organized a series of penitential processions from the major churches of the city, beseeching God for an end to the horrible scourge. Tradition has it that, following the processions, St. Michael the Archangel appeared atop the mausoleum of Hadrian, sheathing his sword as a sign that the plague would cease, which, in fact, it did. From at least the 10th century, the retelling of this tale led to Hadrian's tomb being renamed Castel Sant'Angelo, Holy Angel, hence the statue of St. Michael that is perched at its summit to this day. After the deceased pope was buried came the next shock for Gregory. The people acclaimed him as a new pope. He resisted vigorously, sending an official letter to the emperor begging him not to confirm this election. But, of course, the emperor agreed, not with Gregory, but with the people. A French bishop who knew Gregory wrote that he was planning to flee the city when the people came and carried him away to St. Peter's to be consecrated bishop. Gregory had inherited a mess. The devastating plague was only Rome's most recent problem. The city had been pillaged 4 times in a century and a half, and conquered 4 times in 20 years. It was impoverished and largely in ruins. With no effective government, there was no one to repair the damage to streets and buildings caused by attacks, fires, and earthquakes. Soon after his election, he wrote, "We see what has become of her who once appeared the mistress of the world. She is broken by all she has suffered from immense and manifold misfortunes. Ruins upon ruins everywhere. Where is the Senate? Where are the people? We, the few who are left, are menaced every day by the sword and innumerable trials. Deserted Rome is in flames, her buildings also." But the deplorable condition of the city was not the reason he had wanted to run away. It was the dignity of the episcopal office that frightened Gregory. Quite frankly, he did not deem himself worthy of it. One of the treasures that has come down to us is his commentary on the book of Ezekiel, who had to deal with similar devastation to Jerusalem caused by the Babylonians. One of Gregory's homilies, given to the people of Rome, tells us much about Gregory's character. Here, he comments on the famous passage from Ezekiel 33. "Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel." Note that a man whom the Lord sends forth as a preacher is called a watchman. A watchman always stands on a height so that he can see from afar what is coming. Anyone appointed to be a watchman for the people must stand on a height for all his life to help them by his foresight. How hard it is for me to say this, for by these words I denounce myself. I cannot preach with any competence, and yet, insofar as I do succeed, still I myself do not live my life according to my own preaching. I do not deny my responsibility. I recognize that I am slothful and negligent, but perhaps the acknowledgement of my fault will win me pardon from my just judge. Indeed, when I was in the monastery, I could curb my idle talk and usually be absorbed in my prayers. Since I assume the burden of pastoral care, my mind can no longer be collected. It is concerned with so many matters. I am forced to consider the affairs of the church and of the monasteries. I must weigh the lives and acts of individuals. I am responsible for the concerns of our citizens. I must worry about the invasions of roving bands of barbarians and beware of the wolves who lie in wait for my flock. I must become an administrator lest the religious go in want. I must put up with certain robbers without losing patience, and, at times, I must deal with them in all charity. With my mind divided and torn to pieces by so many problems, how can I meditate or preach wholeheartedly? So who am I to be a watchman? For I do not stand on the mountain of action, but lie down in the valley of weakness. Truly, the all-powerful Creator and Redeemer of mankind can give me, in spite of my weakness, a higher life and effective speech. Because I love him, I do not spare myself in speaking of him. When a neighboring bishop criticized Gregory for resisting his election, Gregory decided to write a book outlining the lofty calling of a bishop and high standards to which he should hold himself. It is hard to overestimate the impact made by this work called the Book of Pastoral Care, Liber Regulae Pastoralis. The Byzantine Emperor Maurice was so impressed with it that he had it translated into Greek and distributed to every bishop in the empire. Several centuries later, the Anglo-Saxon King Alfred would dictate a preface for it, have it translated into Old English, and circulate it among English bishops. The great Charlemagne did the same. In short, this little book became the veritable textbook for bishops and popes for centuries to come. Gregory ranked effective preaching as one of the supreme duties of the pastor. The pastor who does not preach or cannot preach well was, in his mind, not much of a pastor. Anyone ordained a priest undertakes the task of preaching so that with a loud cry he may go on ahead of the terrible judge who follows. If, then, a priest does not know how to preach, what kind of cry can such a dumb herald utter? It was to bring this home that the Holy Spirit descended in the form of tongues on the first pastors. For Gregory, preaching was his number one priority. It should be noted that this father of the church was not an original theologian like Augustine or the Cappadocians. He is above all a pastor who is absorbed with the task of explaining the scriptures to ordinary people. He expounded the Bible according to its threefold meaning: literal, allegorical, and moral or spiritual. One of his famous commentaries, called Moralia in Job, illustrates his method. The literal sense would be the story of Job itself and its meaning in its original context. The allegorical sense would see Job's sufferings as a type or prefigurement of Christ's sufferings. The moral or spiritual sense would be what we should learn and apply to our own lives today from the story of Job. As a monk and a pastor, this third moral or spiritual sense is Gregory's real preoccupation. That's why his commentary on Job is actually titled Moral Reflections on Job. Note here how he goes from the brief description of Job as simple and upright, Job 1:1, to a teaching on the nature of authentic Christian simplicity and how it differs from naive simple-mindedness. Some people are so simple that they do not know what uprightness is. Theirs is not the true simplicity of the innocent. They are as far from that as they are far from rising to the virtue of uprightness. As long as they do not know how to guard their steps by walking in uprightness, they can never remain innocent merely by walking in simplicity. This is why St. Paul warns his disciples, "I hope that you are also wise in what is good, and innocent of what is bad. But also, brothers, you are not to be childish in your outlook, though you can be babies as far as wickedness is concerned." Thus Christ our truth enjoins his disciples with the words, "Be cunning as serpents, and yet as harmless as doves." In giving them this admonition, he had to join the two together, so that both the simplicity of the dove might be instructed by the craftiness of the serpent, and the craftiness of the serpent might be tempered by the simplicity of the dove. That is why the Holy Spirit has manifested his presence to mankind, not only in the form of a dove, but also in the form of fire. For by the dove, simplicity is indicated, and by fire, zeal. So he is manifested in a dove and in fire, because those who are full of the Spirit have the mildness of simplicity, but catch fire with zeal. Gregory took his own advice relative to combining fiery shrewdness with gentle simplicity. He, a simple monk, was thrust into the chaos of pastoral care amidst a collapsing empire. He had been trained both in prayer and in diplomacy, scripture, and governance. He would shrewdly employ all his skills, both spiritual and temporal, for the good of the people. Gregory had no naive illusions. He realized that there was no help to be gotten from the emperor. If the poor were to be fed, the church would have to feed them. If captives were to be freed, the church would have to free them. If the city's defenses were to be rebuilt, the church would have to organize it. Into the vacuum left by an impotent state stepped the Pope, seeking to use all the means at his disposal to fill the void. Thus, it is with Leo and Gregory that we see the beginning of the temporal power of the papacy that was to grow during the Middle Ages and last till the new state of Italy was formed in 1870. It all began not due to some desire for wealth and power, but because the Pope, as the only effective leader in central Italy, was forced either to take over all the normal duties of the collapsed state or watch his people die. Assets were sold, including lands and sacred vessels of precious metals. Considerable number of captives were freed, and thousands were saved from starvation by the relief efforts of Gregory. In fact, he spent so much to relieve the temporal suffering of the people that his successor was left with an empty treasury. Gregory beseeched the emperor to negotiate a peace with the Lombards, the latest barbarian tribe to afflict Italy. He got no response. So without any official permission, he took the initiative to carry out his own negotiations and secured a separate peace for Rome and surrounding cities, saving many lives. To his credit, Gregory is notable for tolerating no persecution of the Jews. He demanded that their property and freedom be respected. He was a champion of the early Christian principle that God works through persuasion, not compulsion. When a Jewish community complained to him that a Jewish convert to Christianity had seized their synagogue and turned it into a church, he mandated that the synagogue be returned to its rightful owners. Gregory made an impact on the imagination and the culture of succeeding centuries in several notable ways. The first was through storytelling. Gregory himself had been inspired by the example of an Italian monk who had died while Gregory was still a child. This monk, Saint Benedict, had grown up and been educated in Rome, but left to live in the hills, outside the city, in pursuit of a prayerful life of penance and solitude. He had founded monasteries and, like St. Basil, had written a rule. But he also was a wonder worker, and his story, which moved Gregory, needed to be told. So Gregory interviewed monks who had lived with Benedict and put together a popular book, written in the form of a dialogue between Gregory and his deacon, Peter, that could entertain and inspire the simplest of people as well as the greatest. Called the Dialogues, it also contains stories of other great Italian mystics and saints. With stories that were easy to hear, remember, and retell, the Dialogues became one of the classics of medieval Christianity in a society where all loved a good story, but few could read. It was carried and popularized all over the continent and the British Isles by the Benedictine monks for whom Benedict was founder and hero. Since it inspired many to join the monasteries, as the life of Antony had, it greatly affected the growth of the monasticism that would preserve Christianity in the West. The second way that Gregory made a difference in culture was through his devotion to the improvement of the liturgy and his care to see that it was enriched with music. We know that Gregory was renowned, even in his own day, as a pope who loved music. We also know that he reorganized and strengthened a school for Christian music in Rome called the Schola Cantorum. Finally, it's clear that he at least collected and organized chant. The whole tradition of chant that ultimately came to be known as Gregorian was probably not all written by him, but he had had a significant role in its development and promotion. It would be hard to imagine English history without Becket, Westminster Abbey, and the Canterbury Tales. But in the time of Gregory, while most barbarians of Europe, including the Goths and the Vandals, were at least Arian Christian, the Anglo-Saxons who had invaded England were totally pagan. Gregory had seen some Anglo-Saxon slaves in the marketplace in Rome and was shocked to find out that they and their land were still unevangelized. So he bought Anglo-Saxon slave boys, gave them their freedom, and educated them in letters and godliness. Next, he sent them back to England accompanied by 40 monks from St. Andrews, led by the monastery's abbot, a man named Augustine. This troop of missionaries established their center at Canterbury and planted the first church among the English. Canterbury remains the primatial see of the Church of England to this day. Gregory's pontificate marks the end of one era and the beginning of the next. The sun was setting on the ancient world and dawning on the new medieval world. A sophisticated urban culture was giving way to an illiterate, rough-hewn feudal society. The barbarian tribes carving up Europe were nomads with no written language. With the exception of the barbarian nobles who lived in the Byzantine society of the East, even the kings would remain illiterate for centuries to come. The Frankish king Charlemagne, crowned Holy Roman Emperor in AD 800, was aware of this and sought to spur a revival of learning in his realm. But it is telling that he himself only learned to read haltingly and never mastered the art of writing. But the age of the fathers of the church, which comes to an effective close in the West with Gregory, had assembled a very rich legacy to be passed on to this new medieval world. The last Latin author traditionally recognized as a father of the church is Isidore of Seville, who died approximately 30 years after Gregory's death. Isidore is a minor figure in comparison with Gregory. This legacy included the Latin Bible of Jerome and the Creed of Nicaea. Augustine's vast theological commentary on the Bible and the Creed were also part of the heritage. This tradition was celebrated in the Roman liturgy, dating back through Hippolytus and Justin all the way to Peter and Paul. In the coming centuries, the monks of Benedict would sing of this patristic legacy in the chant of Ambrose and Gregory, and would nourish the Christian community out of its storehouse of the same rich legacy. It is no accident that the last of the early church fathers in the West, the one who plays such an important role of bequeathing this heritage to the medieval world, happens to be the first monk ever to have become pope. This monk pope was a strong man who wrote about leadership and modeled it. Known as Gregory the Great, this man exemplified the philosophy of evangelical leadership taught by Jesus. This leadership style can be summed up by the new title Gregory developed for himself as pope, a title that has been used by every pope since, Servant of the Servants of God.